Warning, Star Trek From the Holodeck contains adult language and discussions. If you're easily offended, do not continue to listen.
Lock it alone!
Fire.
Holodeck 3 program is reinstated.
Open sesame!
Commander Klingon vessel, we are energizing transporter beam. Now.
Welcome, everyone, to Star Trek From the Holodeck. I am Michael, your host. And today, David is here to help me work through the latest episode of Star Trek Discovery.
Like a good ship's therapist.
Yeah, you're Mike Hulbert. Or maybe this season, you're more like my Tilly.
No? You know what, Tilly? Tilly this year is doing a better job than Culper.
I think she should be the captain. I think it's funny that she decides not to be a captain.
Yes.
But she is way more mature,
than
anyone else on that vessel at this point.
Even compared to Burnham, who basically is like, nah, you know what? I know the captain should normally stay on the ship, but I'm going to go out anyhow.
And depending on how the season wraps, and I don't even know if it matters at this point, but if we had to pick one character, Dave, from the very first season until now, and say this is the best character arc, I think it's Tilly.
I think so too. I'm very impressed with how from season one to this final season, with a character arc like Tilly's, no one's really talked about it. Like, it's kind of flew under the radar, but when you actually take a step back and compare everyone's character journey, Tilly's seems to be the most well-grounded.
Yeah.
And put together, while, you know, like, you have like over melodrama in Burnham's case, and even with like a character like, let's say, like Stamets or Culber, even.
Mm-hmm.
There's melodrama spiced into it just to energize it more than it needs to be. It like ramps it up to 11 instead of 10. While Tilly, they're like going, if you were to actually take Tilly's story, this is what you would expect out of like an old Star Trek
I agree.
Series.
Yeah. Because that's always been some of our, I know, at least for you and I, some of the best things about the Star Trek shows aren't always about the captain or the first officer. Sometimes it's those side characters that
Absolutely.
End up having amazing stories. Look at Barclay in TNG and in Voyager.
Oh, yeah.
Garrick in Gul Dukat in Deep Space Nine. Rom. I guess Tilly isn't really a side character, but she's also one of those characters that you didn't really expect to have such a definitive storyline.
Yeah.
You can really trace it. It's a lot more clear. A lot more clear. It's more clear than Burnham's in a lot of ways. There's times where we lose sight of what's really making Burnham tick. What is her motivation?
Yeah.
Whereas with Tilly, we understand fully. It's not abstract. It doesn't get muddled. It's pretty clear. It goes from A to B to C.
Especially when you look at it this episode, Burnham's characteristics like go from one side of the spectrum to the complete opposite side of the spectrum season to season. Like, she's like in season one, she's rebellious. She's, you know, suddenly a quick to act type of character, action first before command. And then, you know, the following seasons, it's like, okay, now she's going to be more philosophical. Next season, oh, she's going to be, you know, more into her emotional side, and she's going to let her emotional side go. And so she ramps back to the other side. Well, and it like bounces up and down for Burnham when you actually look at season one through five.
Yeah.
But with Tilly, it's actually a very gradual and well put together character mythos that has like, it goes up, has a little peak, then little dip a little bit, then it goes back up and continues the momentum.
Burnham's is almost like the stock market. Just goes. Yes. It's erratic.
It's erratic.
No, I'm joking. I don't dislike Burnham's story. Her story is pretty good too, especially with what they're doing this season. It does feel like a bookend, because this is the end. Going back to what I had said since the very beginning of the season, when Sonequa Martin-Green was interviewed and they questioned her about the final season, and she said, well, it feels like a happy coincidence because there's a lot of like finality to this. There's a closure in this season, even though we never intended for this to be our last season. And that is a very lucky coincidence, because if they just had a regular season that didn't really bother to bring characters to the characters' maturity and growth to the forefront, mm-hmm. it would have been a travesty if the show ended and we didn't get those moments. Because Tilly is now that we know this is coming to an end, and we'll revisit this topic again at the end of the season, but Tilly's character does feel like it has closure.
It does.
Book's starting to feel like there's closure there. Stamets, mm-hmm. Burnham, Colbert feels like a beginning of something new. And I'm hoping that it gets some resolve before the end of the season.
It does. But I think I really like the fact that, particularly in this episode, we finally get Colbert really kind of come to terms, or actually put it out there that this is what his character has to deal with, you know, actually being reborn again, dying, going through death, being reborn, going through a crisis of at first, you know, like life and death, to like now a crisis of purpose.
Yeah. Hold on real fast, David. We forgot to even introduce what discussion we're doing today. We just immediately got on it. But we are discussing and breaking down episode Mirrors, and it was written by Joanna Lee and Carlos Cisco, and the direction was done by Jen McGowan. So you brought up Colbert, or I should say you went there with Colbert, so let's just talk about him briefly. They gave him a little bit of attention at the end of the episode, those waning moments. Which, by the way, I'm really appreciating that a bit. Now, I know I had my problems with the last episode's ending, but now that we're four episodes in, I can see the trend that they are doing this season. They're literally borrowing a playbook from the original series Star Trek. At the end of the episode, every episode, there's a lesson. And rather than just changing their format in some strange way, there's a reason why there's a lesson. It's because of what they're tracking. Their quest entails an actual lesson. The group of scientists that hid the map, if you will, to where the progenitor technology is located, they embedded little lessons in each mystery.
Yes.
Or in each clue. Obviously, it's to make sure that whoever is on the path to find this technology
is worthy.
So the idea of going to the original series playbook with those end of the episode moments where Kirk, Spock, and McCoy kind of summarize what has happened into like a little philosophical
discussion,
you know, those classic little philosophical epilogues from the original series. I will say that's a pretty creative way to write your scripts. You're justifying the reason why you're going to have those little moments. It's built into the writing, and it just works with how Star Trek started. And I like it because I know this isn't going to be the last time we see this era, but it's an interesting bookend, you know, going from the very beginnings of the original series all the way to the 32nd century now, and seeing where they've come, where they've gone. You get the idea that the Federation has been through so much over the last, you know, several hundred years. So it does feel right. I don't have any problems with any of that. But going back to the third episode, because I received some messages about my hate on that episode. And I get what they're doing with it. It just, it was the voiceover itself. We had the discussion with Burnham and Colbert, and then they beat us over the head with that very poorly written voiceover that felt a little silly. But bringing it back to this episode, I really like what they did with it, because it's not just giving you a lesson. It's also designed to help us flesh out Culbert and what he's going through. And it's a lot like what we were talking about the last discussion. Culbert is not just seeking meaning. Yes, he wants to understand the meaning of life because of his experiences.
Yeah.
But as I mentioned during that discussion, Star Trek has always skirted the line of spiritualism and mysticism. And because Star Trek, as we know, isn't a fantasy. This is, for the most part, a series or a franchise that's built on legitimate science in a lot of ways. So there really isn't a lot of room for the spiritual and the mystic. However, they do find ways to make it work, but it's usually left with a question mark or a philosophical discussion.
Discussion, yeah.
Debating, you know, the various ramifications and details pertaining to the episode, like I mentioned with Baylana mm-hmm. and the Barge of the Dead episode. So they played with that. And I do like that they actually brought that to the surface in an organic fashion rather than just simply saying, I'm on a spiritual quest. But with yes. Tilly being such an interesting character this season, the way they brought the two of them together at the end of the episode, she came to the conclusion about spirituality and science.
And it's a great...
No, she says intellectual. She said the intellectual and the spiritual. And when she brought that up, it was such a great way to really drive home the point when it comes to Culbert and his search, because his search is a spiritual one.
It gave me such a narrative boner when Tilly said that, because like we've already discussed in the beginning of this episode how much Tilly has grown as a character.
What did she say? Both the intellectual and the spiritual both reach for understanding.
Yes. I have it here that hopefully I get the words right. The intellectual and the spiritual are not that far apart from the sense that each bring understanding and can take you to a new place.
Correct.
And coming from Tilly, who since season one started off as this bright-eyed cadet, this naive, the power of science will solve everything, to a more fleshed out, mature character who has been through the fire, so to speak, and now has kind of grown into that character that everyone goes to for advice.
Yeah.
And almost like has become kind of like a motherly figure in the Discovery crew.
I think she's just very focused and she has found her place ship.
Out of all the characters.
Yeah.
She's the one who's found her purpose. This mm-hmm. is her purpose.
Yeah.
And I liked that was one of the moments in the episode where I really enjoyed everything, the synergy of the way it was written came together perfectly, because you have a character who, when you take a look at this season in general, where this whole season, the theme is everyone is trying to find their purpose. If you were to say, is there a character that has truly found their purpose right now? It's Tilly. Tilly's found her purpose. She's gone from, you know, the command track, not wanting to be a captain. Suddenly she wants to be a part of the academy. She wants to help Discovery crew. So she leaves the academy and helps her family because that's her purpose. And out of all the characters, she's the perfect one to kind of lead the crew at this point, because everyone else is still in this flux of what is my purpose in this timeline of the galaxy right now.
Well, she's taken, you're right. Look what she's done for Stamets over the last couple of seasons.
Mm-hmm.
Helping him adjust to things, dealing with his personality issues that he definitely has.
She's helping Rayner.
Helping Rayner. Of course, she's always there for Burnham. Yeah. I mean, she's such a great character. And the way they have written her this season is just, it makes her that much better. And again, going back to the ending moments, if we had any questions about one of the philosophical frameworks that they're working through this season, if you remember in our very first discussion, for episode one, I said that they're dealing with obviously existentialism, but I also said epistemology.
Mm-hmm.
And epistemology is a branch of philosophy concerned with knowledge. Philosophers who study epistemology, they study the nature, origin, and scope of knowledge, epistemic justification, the rationality of belief, and various related issues. So really, I would say existentialism is probably second to that. And the real philosophical groundwork is epistemology.
Yeah.
It's not just the search for meaning.
Yes.
It's the search for knowledge in all facets. And oftentimes, philosophy of religion will intertwine with aspects of epistemology for obvious reasons.
It takes, the thing that really amazes me, especially after this episode, looking back at Discovery compared to like the original series, Roddenberry's original theme with Star Trek was to search out answers for humanity, right? To kind of actually ask those philosophical questions in a more rudimentary way. Discovery, the thing that really impresses me is when Discovery has taken that idea of the idea of Roddenberry is to actually question what being human truly is about, and not just scratching the surface, diving into it.
That's what Discovery's doing.
That's what they do.
Yeah.
And like, especially with...
They were also, the original series, as well as TNG, they did a lot of interesting stuff philosophically. But
they scratched the surface.
Yes. With these deeper issues in philosophy, yes. What they really focused on a lot in those earlier shows was ethics.
Yes. That's the thing. There's a different... And a lot of people have to understand that we're not... Philosophically, we're not shitting on...
No, it's just different.
On TNG. TNG did their thing about... It was ethics. Was it ethically right?
Yeah.
To do things. Discovery just goes even deeper and says, what is it that makes this...
They're asking questions. That's going to be really... And I we could probably say this now, but I want to save the majority of this particular discussion for the end of the season. But if you were to point at Discovery and have to say, well, what was the biggest defining feature of Discovery? And I'm not talking about negativity. Let's not talk about the negative.
No.
The defining feature for Discovery is its deep dives into the philosophical.
Yeah.
I do not believe seasons of Star Trek have been completely immersed in a very deep philosophy. There's always been seasons of Star Trek with numerous episodes that do amazing things within the field of philosophy. Deep Space Nine, TNG, Voyager, the original series, the movies, they all do it. And they do it very well.
Yeah.
Discovery does it a little differently. They do it a little more nuanced.
Oh, yeah.
But we'll talk about that more when we get to the end. So the main function, really, of this episode was to flesh out Maul and Locke.
Yes.
And at the same time, use them as a mirror to learn more about what Book and Burnham are feeling emotionally on an intimate level. So they killed two birds with one stone.
Yes.
By writing the episode this way. And we did need an episode like this. It isn't the best episode of Discovery, but it was an episode that we needed because it did slow things down a bit. It allowed us to focus on our two leads, which is now Burnham and Book, which sounds like a 1980s,
you know, Burnham and Book.
It sounds like a spinoff from Dragnet.
It kind of does.
So that's really what the episode did at its core. It was really just about fleshing out Burnham and Book's relationship, where they are now.
Yes.
What the possibilities lay in store for their relationship. And then let's get to know Maul and Locke. And for the most part, it was all right. The most interesting part of all of this, though, was how, once again, Kurtzman is just stealing shit from Deep Space Nine.
Yep.
And pissing all over it to claim it.
Yes. Marking it like a cat.
Yes. We finally saw the Breen.
The Breen for the first time.
What they actually look like.
And yes, I was actually kind of really surprised he went there to buy a show.
I was shocked. I was, wait, what the fuck did you,
yeah,
did
you? Because I was like, wait a minute, they can remove their helmets? I thought they're all machines.
I thought the they fuck? Couldn't breathe. I always assumed they just couldn't breathe the atmosphere, so they wore a mask. But it's interesting what they did with it. They actually explained their culture a bit.
Yeah.
And this idea that they reject their solid face.
Yes.
I guess is the terminology for it. Let me look it up to get it exactly right. Hold on. So just to give a little context or background, the Breen, they were mentioned in episodes of TNG in passing, but that was it. There was no clues as to what their culture was really like. I believe they mentioned at one point that the Klingons went to invade the Breen homeworld and the entire fleet never returned. No one ever heard from them ever again. And there was a few other episodes where Data talks about their non-telepathic abilities.
Yes. They were honestly, the Breen are like one of the more mysterious species that, yeah, a lot of Star Trek fans were hoping to get more info about.
And TNG, they were more or less just like a plot device.
Yes.
Just to float some ideas. There was no real exploration of their culture in any way. It wasn't until the later seasons of Deep Space Nine, when the Breen joined the Dominion, that we were introduced to them and,
yeah,
what we thought they looked like.
Yes.
Now, in this episode, flash forward 800, 900 years later, we get to see what they look like. And I'm assuming the Federation, this is the first people who actually ever saw a Breen. Give me a second here. Okay, so we learned a lot about their physiology in this episode. They have a true form.
Yes.
Breen were humanoids capable of surviving in multiple environments. Now, that's something that I believe is new. They also had two faces. That is definitely new. A solid state one, where, yep, their flesh-based skin is green, and a fluid state consisting of green translucent fluid that the Breen thought of as their true face.
And it makes so much sense when you think about it, because they introduced this. This is actually much more recent that they introduced this. It makes sense when you think about their ties in DS9, why they chose the Dominion. I mean, think about it.
Oh,
you have,
wow,
the changeling. You have a changeling race that has a fluid state type of physical state. Of course, that
I didn't even think about that, David.
A race similar like that would side with them.
That's interesting. Dislike the solids.
Yes.
So much so. And we're very distrusting of them. So that,
it would make sense.
This is where Kurtzman era does get some points, because taking, without beating us over the head with it, just little things like that, just like you brought up, make you go, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
What a nice little way to retrospectively connect something in that way.
That's why I liked the one thing I did like about the Maul and Locke scenes is getting to see the Breen, their culture. That was one of the positives. Actually seeing the Primarch look at, I think it's Locke. Yeah, it's Locke. That he looks at him and says, this is Breen. And he basically shows him his face, his liquid face, right? That true green translucent face. And he tells him that this is what Breen are. And I'm like, all right, that's when it dawned on me, oh, wait a minute. This makes sense why the Breen would team up with the Dominion. They're not going to team up with solids.
This actually makes a lot more sense, too. I had forgotten about this. So in the Deep Space Nine episode titled In Purgatory's Shadow, it said that the Breen had no blood or other liquid circulatory system. So that even makes more sense now.
I always thought, the funny part is after that, this is just me as a Star Trek fan, before you get to actually see the Breen, how they introduced them, their culture in this one, I always thought they were machines. I thought they were actually just machine-based organisms underneath that armor. But doing this, I like this better,
yeah,
than my original idea that they were like an AI or they were like a machine-based organism, because it ties so well with not just what Discovery's doing, but also what other Star Trek series do. So it kind of keeps that continuity.
It's consistent. Yeah.
Consistent.
It makes sense. That's what writers should do. When you're working on a franchise that's this, you know, this old, and you're going to have to go back like they do and connect dots, make sure you understand. You can tell that whoever wrote this episode, or at least the showrunner themselves was coaching and guiding them, they understood how they were portrayed in Deep Space Nine. So they then took the assumptions, logical conclusions were drawn and said, okay, well, if they, you know, were connected to the Dominion in this way, and it was explained that they had no circulatory system or liquid blood. All right. Well, this makes sense then if we were to design these species in the way that they did. It shows that they actually cared and they understood the, I guess you could say, the underlining
nuance,
I guess assumption or presumption, I guess you can say.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, it worked. The only problem that I had with this whole Maul and Locke thing.
Let's see if it's the same as mine.
There's no reason to do flashbacks, especially the way it was done, the way it was edited.
This was
those are the flashbacks. Those are the ones I literally make fun of.
Yes,
the ones where
CW flashbacks.
Where the camera zooms in real slow and they're thinking about the past, and then go to the past. That is the cliche, generic flashback.
That is film school editing.
Yeah, actor looks off into the distance.
Quickly.
Ooh, flashback.
Flashback. Let's do a wipe.
It's so stupid.
And I hate it. I hate it, Mike.
I hate it, too. You know what they should have done, Dave? I know it would have messed up. It would have foiled the whole strategy of let's double up and use them to explain what's going on with
Burnham and Book.
But I would argue you can find another way to do that. The episode should have just started in the fucking past.
Yes. Yes, Mike. Yes. I hate this. I hate this for some strange reason.
Just like the episode I said this a while back about, was it? I forget. It was episode two or episode three, where you start like 18 hours earlier. How about you just start?
Just start. And this is something that this goes outside of like the show, outside of just Discovery, because this is something that I have yelled to the mountain. To the mountains, and I've prayed for the writing gods to hear me. Writers out there,
linear writing is a lost art.
Yeah, stop your goddamn nonlinear writing. Just stop it. Stop it. Yeah. Because the whole thing about flashbacks, I get it. I want to wrap everything thematically, David. It has to wrap thematically. You know what? You could do it just like what you just said, Mike. You can actually wrap it thematically differently in a narrative and still keep it linear.
And you know what? Yes. You know what I like even more is I don't have a problem with non-linear writing per se. Not everyone can do it right. This is an example of an episode that doesn't do it that well. You can also go back and forth without doing the terrible idea of a flashback. You can simply start the episode.
Yeah.
In the past with Maul and Locke, tell us what we need to know.
Their story
you can even do intercuts. You can do intercuts from the past to the present. That's nonlinear, but it still works.
Yeah.
When you stop what we're doing, you slow the progress down, have an actor look off to the side, and then flashback. It's just cheesy. It is cheesy, and it is a bane.
And I hate it
on television writing.
I hate it more, particularly in this episode, Mike, because they just didn't do it just once.
No,
they did it four times.
Yeah.
Four times in an episode where I was like going,
they should have just took us there.
They just took us there.
Took us there. If you're going to do the flashback, just go with it. Just go with it and finish it. Quit taking us back and forth.
Stop diddling my writing balls.
Yeah.
Okay. And I've actually said this to, you know, younger writers and students who have shown me their writing stuff and showed me theirs, and they use flashbacks. And I'm like going, why do I have 8 flashbacks in your short film. And why are you going back and forth? Well, I want to do nonlinear storytelling. That's the latest thing. And I want to smack them because you're stopping your momentum of your entire narrative to do what? 3 seconds of a flashback or 3 minutes of a flashback? And this is in this one, Mike, it is just grossly negligent with that type of writing where it's like, okay, we're going to do it when they don't just do it with like what you said, where the actor looks off into the distance and then they fade out. They have to use like little cliche things like, oh, look, Burnham and Book go into the wormhole and there's a bright flash. And suddenly we're in the past. Why are we in the past? Why did you have to use something separate that has nothing to do with your flashback to instigate your flashback? And that right there is like CW writing. That's what irritates the crap out of me. If you're going to give me an explanation of a character, just give me the whole thing. Give me the whole thing right in, just like you said, Mike, right in the front. That way your story is linear and your audience will appreciate it more because, you know what? You want to throw the parallel, this mirror of Book and Burnham and Locke and Maul. Have the first half of the episode be focused on Locke and Maul and their story. And then the second half of your episode is Book and Burnham.
Yeah. It would have. You know what, David? Can you rewrite this, David? Because that's actually a good... I would be okay with that. That's actually a decent way to still give them the mirror aspect.
The mirror aspect. Yes,
you're right. 100%. I agree. So we also got a little bit on the Chancellor of the Terran Empire. When Burnham and Book go through this little interdimensional portal, they find that at some point in time, the ISS Enterprise had also gone in there, seemingly to escape from the Terran Empire.
Yes.
I'm assuming the scientists that were hiding the progenitor information had used it as one of the places to hide clues.
Because they were I think they alluded to the fact that the scientist himself was actually from the
Terran Empire.
From the Terran Empire.
So we get this picture now that explains that at some point, Saru from that universe, the Terran universe, had decided to rise up and he became a revolutionary and he resisted the Terran Empire and a group of people ended up on the ISS Enterprise and many of them found a way into the Prime universe and they lived out their lives in that universe.
Yeah.
Now, as they were trying to search for information, they stumbled upon some relevant information pertaining to Spock. Now, they didn't mention it by name, but we know if you go back to the original series.
Yes.
Captain Kirk, when he crossed over to the Terran Empire, spoke to the Terran Spock and advocated that he change.
Yes.
And that he do something different, that this doesn't have to be the way things are. Mm-hmm. That essentially, he was telling him that he knows a version of him that is everything you can be. And then Kirk goes back to his universe, and we don't really know what happens to Spock until Deep Space Nine.
Until Deep Space Nine and the comics.
And they don't count. But Deep Space Nine, that's canon. Deep Space Nine explains that Spock, at some point, adhered to Kirk's advice and rose up and became the Chancellor.
Yes.
But people turned on him. That was clear in Deep Space Nine.
In Deep Space Nine.
That they turned on him. And it failed ultimately. And the Terran Empire fell apart.
Yes.
And became weak because of Spock's reforms. And that made way for the Cardassian and all the other things that were happening during the Deep Space Nine era. So now flash forward back to Discovery, and they say that the Vulcan High Chancellor, who was trying to make reforms, was assassinated.
Yes.
So there's a lot of blogs saying that this is new information, that we've never heard this before, now we know his fate, but we already knew his fate. They just didn't say assassinated.
They didn't say assassinated, but I can actually vouch that there were actually stories done of the Mirror Universe where, it leads to Chancellor Spock.
What stories?
Basically in the comics.
That don't count. It's
not
canon.
I know. It doesn't count. It doesn't count, but it was there.
It's not canon.
It was there.
But it doesn't do anything for this show. It doesn't matter. They also had Q bring, you know, Janeway and Sisko and Picard back. And everyone together.
Yes. And that's like a fever dream.
Yeah. So we got a little bit on, I guess, some clarification on the Vulcan High Chancellor. Now, I think many of us who are avid Star Trek fans probably were waiting. We were waiting to hear Spock's name mentioned. It just makes sense on so many levels. Why wouldn't you bring up Spock when you're dealing with Burnham, who's his sister? Well, they didn't. And a lot of people complained that that was such a missed opportunity to bring some closure to that aspect as well. But I would argue there was already closure two seasons ago on that.
Yeah, there's no such thing as closure there, because that's just reopening an old wound.
Yeah. Now the writers did respond to some of these questions from fans. The co-writer of the episode mentioned that they had considered bringing Ethan Peck in to play some version
that would have been interesting
of this ISS, or I should say Terran Spock, but there were availability issues. Or I guess they say hold on, let me get this straight. So in an interview, there we go. In an interview with Trek Movie, Star Trek Discovery season 5, episode 5, co-writer Carlos Sisko says that Star Trek Strange New Worlds, Ethan Peck appearing in some fashion as the Mirror Universe's Spock was considered, but didn't happen. Sisko speculates that availability issues may have been the reason Discovery missed out on Peck playing his goateed Mirror Universe Vulcan doppelganger. We had considered, this is the exact quote here, Ethan Peck as Mirror Spock early on, but there might have been availability issues. I don't know. Well, what? That's not really an answer then. There might have been availability issues. I don't know.
Well, at least we know that there was talks that they were going to do it.
But he then says, I don't know.
That was the best thing he could do, is just sit on that fence.
Or he could just not respond.
Yes.
If he doesn't have an answer.
I don't know.
Don't we learn that in grade school? When you have nothing to say, just don't keep say your mouth shut.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I will say that I'm not a big fan of Easter eggs and silly crossovers that don't matter.
Yeah.
But I will say that I was a bit disappointed, because if you're ever going to do a crossover or have a cameo or an Easter egg, this is something that's not contrived. This actually would work organically. And I will say, I rolled my eyes a bit when I saw the title of the episode. It was Mirror, and then we saw the ISS Enterprise.
Yes.
Obviously, it was double meaning, the title. But my point is that at first I was annoyed, because I thought we were going to cross over. I was like, oh God, here we go again. We're going back. But another happy coincidence in a lot of ways, David. By the end of the episode, I liked the inclusion of this little subplot pertaining to the Terran Empire, because this is where the show started.
Yes. That's what I was going to bring up, is the fact that while this might feel contrived, bringing in the Mirror Universe, oh my God, they're again, Discovery is actually toying with the Mirror Universe. But yeah, that's the whole point. We started in season 1 with Discovery dealing with the Mirror Universe.
Yeah.
So I'm okay with them bringing that type of...
It just feels right.
Star Trek lore, yeah.
It feels right because this is the final season.
This is the final season of Discovery. And for them not to have like little moments like this where they deal with the Terran Empire... would almost take away consistency from season 1, because it would feel like, let's just ignore everything that we introduced in season 1 because we didn't like it, type of thing, you know?
Yeah, running from your shit. Yeah.
And I like the fact that they brought in this fact of like Saru, because if for those that have watched, you know, season 1 of Discovery, the mirror version of Saru was a key player for about like 2 to 3 episodes when Burnham was stuck in the mirror universe.
Mm-hmm.
And that Saru was going to be killed, but Burnham saves him. So I like the fact that basically, hey, look, the person that Burnham saved in season one mattered.
That David,
something happened.
I like it too. Once again, a happy coincidence.
Happy coincidence.
How fucking lucky did they get in a lot of ways to bring something like that back, showing the fate of Saru, that he managed to, you know, meet the challenge.
And rise above being a prey species. Yeah. Remember, the whole point of their species back then was they were pretty much taken in like cattle. And remember, Georgiou ate him.
Ugh.
Would eat Kelpians, which just doesn't...
So did Burnham, didn't she?
Yes, Burnham apparently did. She had to actually put up...
She was in deep cover.
Yeah, deep cover.
Yeah, that's the excuse we'll go with. Secretly, she really liked it. She tastes like chicken.
Come here, Saru. Let me suck on your tendrils.
Hold still. Put some barbecue sauce on this bitch.
Oh, I feel dirty saying that.
Whatever. It's just gangly eye.
He probably would enjoy
it. You can still live without your gangly eye. Look, his fell off eventually.
Someone just walks up. Chicken.
Oh, I can't wait till you mature. I'm going to eat those. I call dibs on your gangly eye when they fall off.
Like giblets. They're chicken giblets.
Just dip them in. Fried calamari. That's disgusting.
Oh, God.
Well, I do want to nitpick here, and then we're going to close out our discussion.
Okay.
Now, I understand that Star Trek, from the very beginning, one of Gene Roddenberry's ideas that was to govern Star Trek was the idea of miscommunication or lack of communication.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't big on villains. He was big on miscommunication. And once you learn to communicate, problems will fix themselves.
Yeah.
I like that. And the reason why I like that is because that's actually true. A lot of problems are simply started because of cultural differences, which is a form of communication.
Yes.
We don't understand varying cultures or just people in general, our neighbors. That's where the problems begin. But through dialogue and understanding, problems resolve. That was an aspect to this episode, and that was a strong element to this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Dealing with communication and understanding varying cultures absolutely worked. But I will say, looking at this as a whole, now, I could be wrong because we're dealing with the Breen as well now. But to find out that there's some sob backstory to Maul and Locke and that they're not really bad guys, I'm like, all right, here we go again. We have not had a real villain in Discovery since season one.
In Star Trek, Mike. In Star Trek, completely.
I'm a little disappointed with that. And I'm a purist in many ways, and I'm about the communication. But when you have four seasons in a row where the villain is not really a villain,
mm-hmm.
it's simply a matter of miscommunication or lack of communication, lack of understanding, cultural divisions. I'm like, okay, you guys, you've done this now. That's in your playbook, and you seem to always go right back to that. And because of that, Discovery, and I will say this, and we're going to talk about this more at the end as well, when the show's over, you can't point to Discovery and point to any definitive things they created.
No.
When it comes to true villains, the reason why Star Trek villains do work, if you know how to write them, like Gul Dukat, for example, just throwing out there, it can still be about communication.
Yeah.
It can still be about communication.
General Chang.
But yes, but you can still have a definitive villain who doesn't have redeeming qualities. Someone that you can really rally behind the team.
Yes.
You need to build that. And sometimes when you build that villain that doesn't have redemption, you learn to understand some, or I should say writers can help use that as a sounding board to flesh out characters, our actual main characters. A good villain will bring out some of those Roddenberry-isms in our core characters.
Yeah.
Look at what it did with James T. Kirk in Star Trek VI.
Yeah.
Chang was a villain. He He was a bad dude. But the lack of communication wasn't between him and Chang. It was between him and Spock. It was their opposing ideas pertaining to the Klingons. It was also a dissection of the human condition and prejudice. So there was all those Roddenberry-isms there, but we still had a definitive villain. It seems like here in Discovery, we're falling right back into what we've done since season two. Just lack of communication, not really a foe. I mean, I guess you can say the AI were.
But the AI were just non-humanoid. That's the one thing that I'll say about Kurtzman's Star Trek in a whole. The one thing that basically people constantly rally about is like, there's no defining villain that basically all the Star Trek fans are like going, well, where is our Dukat? Where's, you know, Khan?
Look what Gul Dukat did for
For Sisko.
Look what he did for Sisko, Garrett, Bashir on many levels.
Yeah.
Major Kira. Because you had this character that was being written side by side the rest of the characters in the show. You were always able to use him to actually position and situate our key players in varying scripts throughout the season that help expand on each of our character arcs, hold up that mirror, teach them valuable lessons, and at the end of all that, we have a true villain. Discovery keeps missing the boat. And I don't want to say I have a love-hate relationship with Discovery, because I don't. I like Discovery. I like its dives into philosophy, and it is intellectual. But they do make mistakes quite a bit.
I think,
and this is one of them.
I think you're onto something, because it's also comes down to just not Discovery, but just this era of Star Trek in general, where you just cannot have a character be the epitome of evil. You know, you can't have that solid evil character.
Picard season 3, you had the Borg Queen, but even, I would also argue that the real misunderstood villain, who was actually a victim of scientific experimentation, the Changeling.
Yeah. But even then,
and Strange New Worlds has no villains.
But even then,
well, the Gorn, I guess, but
the Gorn. But I mean, like,
they're abstract.
They're abstract, and they're just, that's a species. We're talking about an actual character, an
individual.
An individual we can rally around and say, yeah, he was a villain, a really good villain that all of our heroes can rally against. And it's like, it's funny because I look at it now, and I go, look at like a show like Lower Decks. Me and you crack up with Lower Decks because we see the characters that they introduce, and they've introduced some really hilarious villains in Lower Decks.
Yeah.
And they've done it successfully. But like for the other shows, they're like, no, we can't have someone who's like completely, there's no redeeming quality in them and still write a story. Well, explain Lower Decks. Explain how Lower Decks can actually make a peanut hamper.
Yeah,
still an interesting character, even though Peanut Hamper's a piece of crap.
I don't disagree. I guess you could point to them. Yeah, I don't really count Lower Decks, but I know you love that show, and I'm okay with it. But when I think Star Trek, I don't really point to that. But I will say that's a good example. The fact that Lower Decks can do it,
can make villains,
which is your point. Yeah,
and it's one of those things that me and you have gone back and forth about Discovery, where it's kind of like we want a villain that Burnham can. Where's Burnham's parallel?
We need something more tangible to hold on to in a lot of ways. And we're not going to get it. Now, I do think that the Breen will probably be the bigger threat now. Probably. I think there's going to be it feels like there might be a race now between the Breen and...
If they do more with the Primarch.
Yeah. I mean, or maybe it's just simply a one-off and... We're going to be chasing down Maul and Locke again. But my whole problem is dealing with them now, because I do find them interesting, but they're trying to create these like red, redemptions, you know, like some understanding behind them, but they're also murderers. Like, do you not remember the first episode where they willingly like created this whole destruction and they were ready to like kill a bunch of people on the planet, and the Discovery and Rainer's former ship had to nosedive into the ground? Yeah, it's like, well, you guys are kind of shitty people. Like, why do I want to learn about you and feel sorry for you?
Exactly.
Yeah, so, all right. Well, that might sound a little contradictory because we're talking about wanting villains and then we don't like what they're doing with these villains. But the reason why I say that is because I already know the direction it's going to go.
Yeah.
I hope I don't, but it seems like there's going to be a moment where, you know, in order to give Book legitimate closure, I don't see them doing away with Maul. She is now directly connected to Book. And for Book to have a good ending, Maul can't die.
Yeah. Unfortunately,
she does, then I'm kind of going to scratch my head. I'm like, well, what's the whole point of creating this connection between Book and Maul?
Unless you try to do like an okie doke with your theme narratives with Book and give us something really philosophical to think about.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. We're getting there really soon. Mm-hmm. All right. This takes us to the end. David, give me your RMD score and final thoughts in 30 seconds.
My final thoughts, my RMD score.
David, what are you doing over there? Come on. I'm going to get you a cough button. This is completely unprofessional.
Like a breen, but
Jesus.
My score that I came up with, it was an 82. It was a bit of a dip from the last episode because I enjoyed the episode. Mm-hmm. There are elements in this episode that I really did enjoy. I like the Tilly stuff. I like Rainer taking command. I like The Terran stuff was really good. I just, you introduce flashbacks to me once and it irritates me. You introduce it four times and it's freaking annoying.
the reason people may not understand,
that is bad writing.
People may not understand why we hate on it so much
because it's bad writing.
It is bad writing. It's a crutch.
Yeah.
Because I'm okay with flashbacks if they're done well, but the problem is you can always tell when a writer is just trying to lean on it.
Yes.
Because they should have fleshed out some of these things earlier in different ways, and rather than trying to work for it, they just say, well, you know, we'll just go back and show you in a flashback.
Yeah.
That's weak.
And that's weak. And that's why I really grade this episode much lower than the past episodes, because bad writing to me is like irritation.
Yeah.
And so with that said, I gave it 81. I thought it was a good episode.
You just said 82. It dropped 1% while you were talking.
Sorry, 82. 82. But like, the bad writing in itself is like what irritates me the most. The format of the story.
Yeah. So it's a 79 then. I'm right there with you. I was going to say 83%, but it's anywhere between 80 and 83, but I'll be charitable.
You could be charitable.
And just say it's a soft 83%. It had some writing problems. Overall though, I did enjoy the episode.
Yeah.
I do dig what they gave us. I like the interesting stuff with the Breen, the epistemology stuff, what they're doing with Tilly, everything you just said. I agree. I like it. But the writing of the script itself had a lot of problems.
Yeah.
All right. That brings us to the end. Thank you, David.
Thank you. Live long and prosper.
I couldn't help but notice your pain.
My pain?
It runs deep. Share it with me.
End simulation.